Welcome to Heartland Darkland. I'm Shannon.
And I'm Cassie.
Hey, Dark Hearts. Oh, we could have said that in unison. We should have planned that out and like counted down.
We could have. I mean, this is our second attempt at an intro since I clearly can't remember our alternating presence.
You know, it's fine. It's just been a long week and it's late at night for us to be recording, so...
It's been a long couple weeks, and this is the second episode we're recording within a couple days of each other.
Yeah. We're, like, trying to get ahead of the game, and...
Right?
That's why I was like, I need to do this while it's fresh in my mind, because I kind of started looking at the one I'm doing for my next case, and I was like, I'm going to get them all mixed up, so let's just record it while I have it, and we'll go from there.
That's very fair. So real quick before Shannon jumps into her story, yet again, reminder, you guys, please review and then like rate and review, like actually leaving a review, commenting where you can helps us a ton. And when you guys do that, rating and reviewing wherever you can, wherever you're listening, just let us know so we can enter you into the drawing for the tote bag that we're going to give away. You know, we'll go all the way up to like 11:59 p.m. on June 30th that you can get those messages sent to us. I won't lie. We probably won't do the drawing until after July 4th.
I mean,
make sure we have, I mean, if we're ahead of the game, listen, just to set expectations a little lower, it'll be after July 4th. But if we're ahead of the game, it'll be before then.
So you might be pleasantly surprised, but just don't hold your breath.
Also. Exactly.
Okay.
So I think that's the only announcement we have. So Shannon, where are we going?
We're going to Ohio.
Ohio.
Cleveland specifically. Ohio. I didn't realize that Ohio was technically in the heartland when I first started looking. So
listen, if you Google it, it'll tell you there's a bunch of southern states that are technically part of the heartland too, like Alabama and Arkansas.
Louisiana, didn't it say that too?
Yeah, Louisiana, Mississippi, Tennessee. I'm sorry, we count those as southern states.
Correct.
If anyone is from there and listens to listens and they're offended that we don't think that they're part of the heartland, you got to pick one. You're either heartland or you're south, and you guys seem south to me.
Yeah. And go with south, because that's kind of what they're known for. And there's a lot of cool things in itself there for being southern states.
Well, and let's be honest, the southern, like, there, I haven't listened to it, but I've heard good things about, but there's like a podcast called Southern Fried True Crime. So I'm sure you guys are covered in there.
That's actually cool. I like that. Okay.
Right.
So yeah, Ohio is definitely in the realm of the heartland. So this case, it's fairly newer. I know I had talked about in the past, we were like, well, do we want to do cases that seem to be well known? But also we decided how, just because we know about all the cases, we think we know all about the cases. And that's like a hobby of ours, clearly, that we like to do. So just because we know doesn't mean everybody else knows. And even then, sometimes you just don't know the details and you've just heard a little bit about it. So
or it's been a long time since you've heard it, because like even as I'm researching my next case, like I knew about it and I knew there was horrible details to it, but I forgot just how horrific some of the stuff was. And so there's that. But I do. It is one of those things that's kind of funny, because real quick, not funny, haha. Like one of my neighbors tries
ironic,
to give
funny.
Me. Yeah. One of my neighbors has tried to give me a case idea tonight. And she's like, Texas is heartland, right? And I was like, no, that's definitely south. But she was like, well, did you hear about this couple who like 40 years ago was murdered? And I was like, and their daughter was just found because of DNA. Uh-huh. Like I for sure follow all the things.
Like, I had someone send that as well. And I was like, yeah, saw that like days ago, but okay.
I know. And I love and appreciate all of those things. Just like my friend Lacey, who listens, like I sent her all the Murdaugh murder stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I know she probably has already seen this because I know she follows the case. But on that off chance she hasn't seen this yet. I would feel horrible if I didn't send it.
I know. And how many times have we sent each other something and we both are like, oh yeah, I just saw that. Like very rarely is it something neither of us have seen. So it's kind of fun.
Right. And so that long tangent was just to say that we get to the point where we feel like everyone must know this case, but that might not be the true, or it's been a while. And you know what? I think sometimes, like, our goal isn't to cover all the major cases, but sometimes they're going to be in there. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So,
well, and when I was like researching, I even reached out on like my personal Facebook page asking people, and people gave a lot of ideas, and they were all ones I had like kind of seen. So I read a little bit about each one, trying to decide. And then I just came back to the one that always kind of sparked my interest. And I remember when this case happened. And it was, this one's a little different, I guess, than the other ones we've done, because it actually has a happy ending in a sense, I guess. But I mean, it's horrible, the things that happen to these people, but the ending is good. So it's kind of a different side of things, but I guess that's good that there's hope. But this story is the Cleveland kidnappings. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, but I'm going to give a trigger warning too. There's a lot of domestic violence, rape, sexual abuse, suicide. There's a lot. So depending on where that hits, you know, you might not want to listen, or just be aware that that is going to be talked about. So we're going to start talking about Ariel Castro. So he's the bad guy in this story, just spoiler alert. He's okay. So he's the reason we're here telling this story. He's a monster. But he was born in Puerto Rico in 1960. So he moved to the United States, specifically Cleveland, when he was just a child. So I don't need to go into a lot of detail about his childhood. But you know, by the 80s, he had a pretty serious girlfriend. Her name was Grimilda Figueroa. I shouldn't even have said the last name. Let's just go with Grimilda. So they were pretty serious. They actually moved in together, and they lived in the basement of Grimilda's sister's house. So they were down there, and Grimilda's sister said that she often would hear Ariel beating Grimilda. So had beaten her very severely multiple times. And so bad that like several of these beatings ended with so many different injuries, including a broken nose, broken ribs, broken arms. He even threw her down the stairs, and she cracked her skull, which caused her to have a brain blood clot. And that eventually formed in an operable tumor.
Okay. That is horrible. And I'm not trying to put any blame on her sister, but if you heard all of this,
I know. And it didn't say like when, I mean, they obviously heard it when it happened, but then it's like, well, why did nobody do anything about it? Or maybe they did. And I didn't look up all those details. Right. It was more of giving the background of what kind of person he like clearly is. Yeah.
I mean, we already knew he was a monster from the exes. I remember when the women were found.
Mm-hmm.
I remember that news story breaking.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm jumping ahead.
No, you're good. You are good.
That's so an inoperable brain tumor. And maybe I'm getting ahead yet again, but did she die of this?
Eventually she does, yes, but not at this time. So at that point, he does get arrested. So this is in 1993 then. So he gets arrested for domestic violence. So, but he ends up being not charged with this. Don't know exactly what happens. That happens,
like
the
Beatrice Six case.
Yeah.
Who was charged with rape, but then it was just all dropped.
Mm-hmm. And it didn't really even say why, but I mean, that's enough to know that this guy already is getting away with something terrible. So Grimilda then, she obviously leaves him and takes her daughters. So it never really said if they were his daughters. It specifically said her daughters. So not quite sure on that. There's a few things on that I was unable to find, but she leaves and she gets a temporary restraining order on him, which was later dismissed. Once again, not sure why. So she ends up dying in 2012 due to complications with the brain tumor. So I feel like at that point, he should have been charged with something because...
How is that not, like, somehow, like, manslaughter right. or something, you know? Because...
I know. Because it caused... I mean, I know it's way down the road then, but it's, like, because of that, she had this injury that eventually killed her that wouldn't have if he wouldn't have beat her, right? I mean...
Right. And if she'd had all these broken bones and stuff before, and I get that maybe she didn't press charges and stuff, and they can't do anything if she doesn't press charges,
right.
but this final time around, how was that not, like, an attempted murder charge or something?
Yeah. I have no idea. And I was like, yeah, that was kind of weird when I was reading the background on him, but I was like, okay. I was like, I'm not going to focus too much on that, but I am right. curious. So, I mean, if anyone knows that, I mean, I'm sure I could dig into that later on. But since that wasn't, like, the main story I was telling, I mean, you can see what kind of a horrible person he is. And he basically yeah. got away with murder right then and there, if you think about it. So,
right.
So that happens. So then it doesn't say, I guess that was, well, she dies in 2012. So, then eventually Ariel lives at 2207 Seymour Avenue in the Tremont neighborhood. That's, I mean, somewhat significant later on, just because that right. is the street that everything happens on. So Seymour Avenue, it's known as, like, the Seymour House. So he was working as a school bus driver from 1991 to 2012. So this was for the Cleveland Metro School District.
Okay, you guys can't see it, but I made the most horrified face, and Shannon just nodded her head, because how does a man like that get a job working with kids?
Right. I see, these are the things, like, I didn't know about the case. Like, I knew the outcome and everything, but then when I was right. finding all this, I'm like, I feel like this could have been prevented so many different times. I mean, you'll see as we go, because, you know,
so many of these cases are.
Always. And that's why it's so unfortunate. And I think it's so important to be, like, sometimes I think I'm overly observant about things, but then I read things like this. I mean, we haven't gotten into that yet, but, or even just other things that I'm like, you know, that time that I thought something was weird, maybe I should have said something, even if it was a stretch, because you just don't know.
Yeah. But as women, we're raised to be polite and all this and ignore our gut instincts, you mm-hmm. know, and our discomfort to make sure we don't make other people uncomfortable or offend right. them. And that's something that we need to, you know, yeah.
super kind of don't care anymore. Break. I'm like, nope.
I've got a sticker that says fuck politeness.
Yeah.
Because yep. my safety, my children's safety, my family's safety is more important than making sure I don't hurt someone's feelings. Listen, if you give off creepy vibes and I think you could potentially harm me or mine, and it turns out you were just a socially awkward person, sorry for ya.
Right.
But I think you can understand that I'd want to make sure I'm safe.
Yeah, I know.
And I think if you can't, then you're just an asshole.
Yeah. And it's just this day and age, you can't really be too careful. So the fact that he was a bus driver, I'm like, cool, never putting my kid on a bus ever.
Yeah, my kid rides a bus. So.
Yeah, but it's different. It's different, Kelsey. Okay, so he eventually gets fired from that because for his, they use the term bad judgment. Okay, tell me if this is bad judgment. So first, he had made several illegal U-turns. That was the first thing that popped up. Okay, maybe that's bad judgment, but you have to have a wide thing or you'd be going up a hill, like the curb, and I don't even know.
Listen, I live on a corner and I have watched a school bus hit our stop sign just trying to make a turn.
Okay. Nope. So when they said that, I was kind of like, really? Okay, that's bad judgment. But then these other things, okay. He used the bus to run personal errands, like getting his own groceries. Yeah, load her up, I guess. I don't know. And he also, this is where I'm like, this is not just bad judgment. He left a child on the bus when he went to lunch. And another time he went home to nap and left a kid in the bus. Sounds a little bit more than just bad judgment.
That's not bad judgment. That's like
it's being an asshole.
It's just like the bus driver we had here recently who just kicked the student off when the kid was like, this isn't mm-hmm. my stop.
And oh, that was so heart-wrenching.
So traumatized. Yes. Mm-hmm.
That video of him on the doorbell.
Yep, I saw the doorbell camera video and that was heartbreaking. But I want to know, one, why is there still a child on your bus in the afternoon?
And why just is there, one? Yeah, just one. Thank you. That's also what, like, I thought was strange.
Yeah. School field trips are a thing. I get that. But why is there just one? And why did this, was this able to happen more than once?
Correct. Yeah. I'm sorry. After he got caught doing like one of those things, how did he still have a job? I guess this was 90s, early 2000s, but still.
Yeah, I
there's
guess
some
so.
Standards. Parents still loved their children that day and age, right? So, like, you wouldn't fly now.
No, I just don't. I don't understand why there's one singular child on a bus.
Twice that happened too. Yeah. I'm like, yeah. So, yeah.
Okay, he's fired for definitely more than poor judgment.
That's kind of his life up until we're going to talk about the crime itself and the whole story. That's the background on him, what kind of person he is, and what he did a little bit, I guess, prior to this story. So now we're going to jump to August 23rd of 2002. We're going to talk about Michelle Knight, who was 21 years old at the time. Also, I got a lot of my information from, there's several books, several documentaries. The one I'm going to be referencing a lot in here, which I will give all that information later on, it was on Discovery Plus, and it was called The Cleveland Kidnappings. And this one was, I'm not going to lie, I was bawling like at the end of it. And I'm like, I usually don't have that kind of a response to something like that, but the victims themselves talk on there. Oh. And so hearing it from their standpoint and stuff, it's very crazy.
Always gut wrenching. So was that like a straight up documentary then, or was it like an episode? Okay.
Yeah. It was, just called the Cleveland, Kidnappings. Well, and I will give you some other ones too. Yeah. I have a whole list of books and stuff, because all the victims have like written books, which I'm like, I wish I had time to read all of them. They're obviously going on my list to read. But so, okay. Michelle Knight was the oldest of all of them. And this is 2002. So when they interview her, she tells exactly kind of what happened. So she said that day, she was actually on her way to a custody hearing for her son. He was currently in the state's custody, and she was hoping to get him back. She was driving around trying to find the place that she was supposed to go and couldn't find it. And she eventually stopped at a store and just ran in to ask someone for directions, because this is still 2002. Cell phones are like a thing, but not like they are now. Like,
I'm pretty sure MapQuest was still definitely I don't think we had GPS cell phones yet.
No.
MapQuest all the way, because I know
we'd print the pages off and like write notes on them and stuff. Yeah.
Because I remember even up in like 2007 or 2008, I used MapQuest to go visit my friend in Sioux City, Iowa.
I know.
To get to her place.
I agree. I mean, that wasn't even in. I mean, even then, if it was available, not everybody had the fancy phones that could do it.
Right.
So, and I never would like trust those initially, because I'd be like, I don't know, is this right? But
well, and I know they had like the navigation systems like Garmin and stuff, but those were expensive. So I know my mom had that for a while, but it was like bulky and.
Yeah. No, it's funny because times have
changed.
Okay,
so she goes in. Yeah. She goes in to get
She asks for directions, and let me find where I was here. Okay, so as she's asking for directions, there's a man in the store that overhears her asking, and he buds in and says, "Oh, I know where that is." And she immediately recognizes him, that it's her friend Emily's dad, and his name is Ariel Castro. So he told her that he would give her a ride there. And I don't know why this was the thing I thought was weird. Why doesn't she just follow him or like take his directions or write it down? I don't know. But she gets in the truck with him, because I think
it's one of those things. If you're one, she's probably already nervous and flustered because she can't find the place and she's trying to get custody of her child back.
Yeah. And you don't want to be late. And
And two, this is someone she knows, like she recognizes and trusts, which, okay, so at this point he has a child then? He has a daughter?
Yeah. He has more than one, because it talks about different ones throughout the thing and the whole story. And I'm not quite sure. They never really go into detail on that. So I'll talk about a couple. Actually, I think there's maybe just two. I think two of them. But so Emily, the daughter. Sorry, my dog. I hope you can't hear my dog make it. She's
snoring. Nope, I can't hear anything.
Okay, she's snoring. Okay, so she gets in the car or the truck with him. So he's driving an old truck that was kind of an orange-red color. While they were driving, they talked about his daughter and just things about her since she was friends with her because that was what they had in common. So as they're driving, she realizes that they're going the wrong way, and she told him that. He said he had to actually stop by his house really quick because, yeah, he had puppies and he really wanted her to have one for her son when she got him back. So cool. classic one. Puppy in a van line.
Right. I'm like,
hey, I got candy too. Sorry, go ahead.
I got puppies and candies for your son. Cool. Yeah. As soon as I'm on time and get him back, we'll come get a puppy.
And I'm sure, like, obviously, looking back, she's probably like, that was so dumb. Why did I do that? But she also had no reason not to trust him. And she said, when he said the puppy, she was like, oh my gosh, that would actually be great. Like, you know, I don't know also, even how old her son was, but
right.
So he was like, you know, come see the puppies. So they get to his house and they went through his backyard, and she said that he locked the gate behind them when they went in, which she thought was kind of weird, but he told her it was just a bad neighborhood, so it was just safer. So, okay. So they go inside the house, and she thought it was weird that she immediately did not hear any puppies. And anybody who's been around puppies, especially several puppies, that's not quiet. They're all making adorable noises, or they're barking
those
really high pitched.
I
know. Love it. So she doesn't hear puppies, and she immediately was alarmed. Before she even had time to react, he shoved her into a room and he said, you'll never see home again. So she begged him to go home. She said she just begged and begged. He took her clothes, her purse, her ID, everything in her like wallet and purse. She had pictures in there. He ripped them all up right in front of her. Like she just didn't exist anymore.
That's like beyond just being. Mm-hmm.
It's cruel. Know, it's like,
it's malicious and evil. And
And then he proceeds to wrap an extension cord around her neck and hung it from a rod. He chained her feet and her hands, and he put a sock in her mouth, and he left her like that for 3 days.
Oh gosh.
Yeah. She said that her body went numb, and the only thing that even kept her going was thinking about her son. So Michelle went on.
Poor little kid thinking his mom just didn't show up.
I know. And I wonder how old he was. I'm sure. I mean, there's not going to say that necessarily since he was a minor, but like, yeah, I just think how terrible. And I don't know why he was in state's custody to begin with, but they probably just chalked it up to like whatever reason had happened. She's doing it again or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, cause she was 21. So it's not like she was, I mean, just a teenager. So it's easier for them to dismiss something like that. But
right.
So Michelle is there it ends up being a very long period of time, but when she's there, she is tortured, raped, and verbally assaulted for the next several years. Michelle's mom reported her missing, but because she was 21 and an adult, they didn't care too much, like I just said. And they just assumed that she moved away and she just didn't tell her mom. They're like, she's an adult. There's really no reason for us to follow up. There was very little follow up, turns out, too. And later they talk about that, how they really dropped the ball on that.
Yeah.
So she was actually even removed from the National Crime Info Center database 15 months after she disappeared. So basically nobody was looking for her.
See, and what's horrible is because, okay, so she was young, clearly had made some sort of mistakes.
Right.
To get her child taken away, which then I wonder why they didn't go into, like, the family or something, you know what I mean?
I know.
Why he went to state's custody, but that's a whole other thing.
Yeah.
But, so they just chalked it up to, well, she's clearly, you know, it's so messed up because, heaven forbid, a young person make mistakes and get their life together.
It's always that.
It makes you wonder what could have happened if they would have legitimately made an effort. Because then it's like, if you would just have tracked things down, you would have found out. Someone would have realized that she left with him.
I know.
So much could have been avoided.
And I feel like at this point, I feel like, okay, if they should take missing people way more seriously. okay, wouldn't you rather investigate and then find out they're fine than not investigate and find out they're dead? I mean, and I know they just don't have resources, but like, that's just messed up. And it makes me like, that's the kind of thing that has people like lose faith in any kind of justice system, because you don't think you can count on them because of things like this.
Right. Well, if you can interview, because like I get every now and then someone might be trying to leave a bad abusive situation, right, whether it's their parents or whatnot. But if you talk to other people around and like multiple people like, no, this is out of character, then being like, okay, this isn't someone trying to leave an abusive situation. You know what I mean?
I know. And I know. It just makes me really sad for her. And like later on when they are found and stuff, it's sad because it talks about how she didn't really have the homecoming that the other victims had, which I'll tell you their stories too. And then, so it was kind of hard trying to figure out how to tell the story because there's so much to it. So I'll give the basics of how each victim is taken and then kind of come together about what happens as a whole for all of them, and then jump forward to like investigating stuff. And so that way, if there's some stuff in here that you're like, but what about this? Like, I'll probably talk about it later. Cause it was, I really struggled putting this together today because I did it today and I spent way too many hours on it. So, okay. So that was in 2002. So now we're going to go to April 21st of 2003 and we're going to talk about
his birthday.
Oh, that's sweet. Okay. Amanda Berry, she was 16 years old at the time. So Amanda Berry worked at Burger King, and normally after her shift, she would either, you know, one, like her mom would come pick her up, and occasionally she would walk home if there was really no one to give her a ride, but she hated walking home because like, it just wasn't the best area where it was located. So on this day, it was actually the day before her 17th birthday, her friend's dad, guess what his name was? Yeah, this Ariel. Castro, maybe I'm just going to refer to him as Castro because it's like, I don't know, it's kind of a hard Ariel Castro. It's a mouthful to me and I just hate saying
his name. Well, and it ruins The Little Mermaid.
It does. Yeah. Ugh. Castro. So her friend's dad drives by, happens to see her waiting for a ride or whatever. And he's like, I'll just give you a ride home. So, okay. There wasn't a ton of detail because she actually, on that documentary, she was the only victim that wasn't on that specific one. But she did a lot of news interviews and stuff with like 2020 and stuff. So you can see all that. But she goes with him and he actually just takes her to his home. And it just basically said he chains her up like he did Michelle like 2 years prior. She was raped multiple times and she even kept track of how many times she was being raped. So she could eventually, she said she wanted him to get punished eventually. We'll talk about her time in the house more later. Cause there's some big significant things that happened with her, but they never said the number of times. And I'm glad because I'm sure.
Yeah, that's vomit. That's horrifying. And to keep track, I can't even imagine.
Mm-hmm. And I think so, 21 years old, 16 years old, and you know, that's just so young. So, okay. So she's missing and her mom, actually, I just like loved her mom on this documentary. They talked to her a lot. And I mean, she was so adamant that her daughter was out there somewhere. And I think if it wasn't for her pushing as much as she did for them to even look, a lot of this wouldn't have happened. So she said right away, my daughter would never get in a car with a stranger. So it had to be someone she knew if she left with somebody. And the police just said, well, she probably, you know, ran away. So they waited however long and her mom just kept pushing so hard with the police. And eventually, you know, they get a little bit farther with that and they, you know, are searching and they're not coming up with anything. So a week after Amanda's been gone, her mom actually gets a call from Amanda's cell phone and it's a man's voice. And he says that Amanda was with him. Don't worry. And just hung up. That was it. And she said that she was trying to like, can I hear her? Can I see her? How do I know she's there? And he just hung up. Nothing. So she was like, okay. But thankfully back in 2003, they were still smart enough, I guess, or it was a thing that they thought, well, let's see if we can get a ping off her cell phone of where it's at. So they were able to do that. And it, you know, gave them a somewhat, I mean, it wasn't a huge area, but not a tiny area. So that's in the neighborhood. Ironically, Seymour Street was included in that ping. And they went to every house. They asked everybody. They even talked to Castro and nothing. They couldn't find anything. And it just turned up empty handed.
Well, it's not like he's like, oh, yeah, you're right. I took her.
I know.
Why don't you come on in?
Yeah, it's terrible. Like, and then in the documentary, they even talk to one of the cops and he gets really choked up and he says, I get chills thinking about how I was standing outside that house and those girls were in there and I had no idea, you know? And
yeah,
so I just think that's terrible. But I mean, it was crazy too, because Amanda's mom was very adamant that Amanda was close. She said, moms know these things. I feel it in my heart. She is close around here. And so she didn't give up hope. So she just kept looking, and that's kind of where they're at on that. So that's a little bit about her. So now we'll talk about, we're going to go to April 2nd of 2004. So we're going to talk about Georgina DeJesus, I think is how you would say her last name. But she goes by Gina. So we'll talk about her as Gina. She was 14 years old. So they're getting progressively younger as we go.
Yeah.
So she is on the documentary, and she talks and she says that that day was like any other day. After school, she was with one of her good friends, Arlene, who also happened to be Castro's daughter. So she didn't live with him, but it was obviously his daughter. Right. So they were talking about how they wanted to have a sleepover that night. So they walked to a nearby payphone because they're 14 and it's 2004. And Arlene called her mom and asked her if they could have a sleepover that night. So her mom said no. So, you know, they're sad, whatever. And so Arlene leaves. So she leaves, and shortly after she's gone, Castro pulls up, ironically, and sees he sees Gina. Yes. Okay. So he sees Gina and he asks her if she will help him find Arlene, which is his daughter. And of course she knows him because that's her friend's dad. And like her family knew him because she was also Puerto Rican. So like that whole area, they all kind of lived in the same area and they all knew each other. So
how ballsy to take people who know
I you. Know. And it, like, sick, like your own friend's kids and stuff. Like, yeah. Like
you're, yeah.
I don't know. And that's, I think, yeah, that's just, I guess, how we knew he could get him in the car, I guess. I mean, she's 14. Like, I don't know. And she probably didn't think anything of it. Will you help me find my daughter? Okay. Yeah. Why wouldn't
I? Right. But I mean, that's just it though. It's like, okay. So with, the girl prior, the girl right before Gina.
Amanda,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her mom was saying she wouldn't have gotten in the car with anyone she didn't know. So the people who were pinged in that area, like, I don't know. Couldn't right. you have done something more if you're like, hey, she would have known. She knows your daughter. There's a connection to this person.
I know.
Do something more extensive there. Like, that just seems like.
Yeah, I know. It seems like they dropped the ball there big time.
And so then. But that's where, too, it just seems so ballsy to take people who know you and right. who your kids Connect. Know, mm-hmm. because then your kids, like, how do people not, I guess at this point, it's probably depending on how many kids he has and stuff like that.
Right.
But, and looking at it from this outside, but it's like, well, we're not putting together that, yeah. all, like, are these girls like, not talking to each other? Like, it's weird that all of our friends are going missing.
I know. But, like, they're all, well, okay.
But they're so different ages.
Also, yeah. So they talk about that later too. So initially, Michelle isn't even really on the police radar. So they don't realize that she's even tied in with this. So when Amanda goes missing, you know, it's a huge deal. Sorry. And
drop my mic. I'm so
yeah,
sorry.
You're good. Literally drop the mic. Okay.
Yeah.
So it just scared me. I was like, oh. So so Amanda goes missing, and that's like a huge case in its own, you know? And then when Gina goes missing, cause it's on a, she's on the, like the, not the other side, but it says something about like the west side of Cleveland. I'm not familiar with it enough to know, but they weren't in the same area. So,
okay.
And they were different ages and they were a year apart. So they both have different investigators looking into their thing, you know, their cases. And then eventually when they're both on like the America's Most Wanted missing thing, that's when they kind of make the connection like, hey, they were, you know, this, all the things that were similar. And that's when they connected them together and thought, okay, maybe these girls are, it's the same person. So they still don't know anything about Michelle, but.
Right. Because of course we right. can't take that seriously in any way, shape or form.
Right. And so, yeah. So she goes with him. They're looking for Arlene at this point. So, she said that when they were driving around, she just kind of felt like something was off. And she kind of just, you know, when you can just tell, you know, and you so.
Gut instinct is such a real thing. But again, oh, yeah. This is an adult. This is an yeah. adult I know. So my friend's parent. So I have to be respectful, even if I'm uncomfortable.
Exactly. So he stops at his house. He said, actually, I need to run home first because I need to get something that I need to give to her, to Arlene. So, okay. So they go there and he says, well, can you come in and help me with it? So she goes in and she said, when she went in, she knew right away because when they went in, he took her right to the basement and he taped her mouth shut and chained her up. And like his other victims that were still in the house, he proceeded to rape her multiple times. And on the documentary, when they talk to her, she even stops and just says, I don't want to talk about that. And so, I mean, obviously it's traumatic, but yeah. it just makes you sick to think of a child, you know?
Yeah.
So,
oh my God, yeah. my heart is broken for these women.
Oh, I know. And it unfortunately and the time gets worse.
They lost,
but...
like, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, Gina's family knew something was wrong when she didn't come home either. She came home. Well, she was supposed to be home, you know, at a certain time and she wasn't. And her family thought, well, she's just, you know, messing around with her friends. She'll be home. So then about a half hour later, they knew something was wrong. So they searched, you know, the route that she would walk home and all that, couldn't find her anywhere. So they knew that, you know, she was friends with Arlene. So they talked to her and she said that she had last seen her when they were at that payphone. So once the police were involved, they even took out the police dogs and they picked up her scent at the payphone. But then after that, the dog couldn't find it. Like they traced it from the school. Yeah. So that's how they were able to like determine that that's where whatever happened. So a witness that said he may have seen Gina before she disappeared, he gave a description to the police and they made a composite sketch based off that. They weren't even sure if this was the person they were looking for because this guy wasn't sure, but they thought like, we're going to go with it because why wouldn't you? And so, let me see here. Okay. Sorry. I kind of lost my spot. I'll post a picture of it because the picture is pretty crazy how similar it actually looks to Castro. So they described the, you know, suspect, as a Latino man who is between 25 and 35 years old, about 5'10", probably between 165 to 185 pounds, green eyes and a pencil thin beard. And just for comparison purposes, Castro was actually 5'7", 179 pounds, brown eyes, and he did have a goatee.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty similar. And, but like to me, okay, if someone was like, well, how much do you think they weighed? I don't know. I'm terrible. Like, how
I'm
do these people get
to judge height and weight? Like, there's and, no way.
Right.
Even when
how
I
did this guy?
Banks,
yeah. Go ahead.
At banks in the doorway, you'll notice they have measurements on the sides. You can kind of tell.
Yeah, even... I never knew that.
So
that's actually
robbed,
smart.
You can say, but I'm like, I would still be like,
who's gonna
I
say, hold
no
on,
idea.
Let me look at that. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-mm. I
mean, I don't
there's
know.
Cameras now, so it's fine.
That's true. Well, and like, unless you were judge. Up close, how would you know he had green eyes? Like, that's a reach there. But I don't know. They didn't say how he saw him or where. They just said a
right.
witness. So that was pretty crazy. So it was interesting because when they released that sketch, Gina's dad thought he looked really familiar, but he couldn't figure out who or why. And
couldn't
other people
it.
In their family thought the same thing. They're like, how do we know this guy? So they were kind of like onto it. I feel like early on, all the signs were there, you know, but you just, I don't know. So at least at this point, they look at all the employees of her school, since that was the last place she was. They look through the list of all the employees. And so there was one guy that pops up on the list who actually had been convicted of rape in the past. Not sure how that happened. They even said they're not sure how that fell between the cracks, like how he got a job.
Someone clearly dropped the ball and didn't make a background check.
So, yeah. So they're like, okay, obviously we want to talk to this guy. So they go approach him. I don't know where. I think probably maybe at the school or something when he's working, because he ends up at home at the end of this. So they go to talk to him, and he just like freaks out and runs off. So he goes home and they chase him. And this was just like a crazy part of the story. They get to his house like right after he ends up killing himself.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, he just freaked out and left because he didn't want them to talk to him. And on the documentary, the cop was like, we just wanted to ask him some questions. Like,
I think that makes me think, is there some other case out there that's not solved and that he thought was coming for? And so he was like, I would rather kill myself than spend time in jail. Yeah.
Well, and especially because he's not the one who did this specific crime. So why do that if you have an idea that they're looking for this missing girl, but you know you don't have anything to do with it?
I mean, unless it's violating his, which I don't know how it wouldn't, being a sex offender is going to violate his probation. But even then, to go, like, that seems drastic to just be like, yeah. Oh, well, even if he wasn't on probation, I mean, he probably would have gotten in trouble for being a sex offender working around children.
Yeah, he probably couldn't even get that job. Yeah.
That seems drastic, though, for just that. Like, it makes me, and I mean, maybe it was simply that. And he was like, I don't want to go back to prison, and so I'd rather do this. But it feels too drastic for him not to have done something that he's gotten away with.
I know. That's what I thought. And I just thought that was a crazy thing in the story. It's like, not only was there all this other stuff, but then something so horrific, they were like, this didn't have to end that way. And not only that, but then they were like not able to ask him anything. And so they literally were back to like square one, because, you know, they again had searched his house and everything, and there was nothing that even connected him to Gina, because they were looking into Gina's case at this point. And, you know, this is also where they made a really big mistake. So I talked about how Castro worked for the bus system. So they only looked at current employees. If they would have looked at previously employed people, former employees, his name would have popped up on that list, and they would have probably looked into it. And that was, they even talk about that later on. They're like, I mean, who would have thought, you know? So that was just another like, oh, all these things, but I mean, coulda, shoulda, woulda, you know, that whole thing. So, I mean, I think if anything, it's good for the future, because they learn things from these terrible things, you know. But so Gina's family, she has a huge family, and they're all very close, and they hold, you know, several candlelight vigils for her, and they have different search parties. And Castro actually joined several of those and was there and was, you know, comforting them and everything. It's just sickening.
Again, that's so ballsy. Like, I know a lot of times, like, serial killers and things like will do that, but there's literally a sketch of you out there.
And I just feel like by putting yourself out there, you're making your face more visible, where now they're going to be like, wait, maybe that's why I remember. And you're putting them in your mind, like out of sight, out of mind, go away. Maybe they won't think of you, you know, but it's like almost like he wanted to taunt them. That's like, he's just evil. So
so gross and so evil.
Yeah, totally. So now I think I kind of talked about this earlier, but they had connected the two cases now at this point. And so they are just kind of assuming that they're together. So as time goes on, they're just so desperate for anything that Amanda's mom, who is still very adamant that she is out there, she was so, so desperate to find her. So she even went on, I don't know what talk show it was, but psychic Sylvia Brown was on the show, and they asked her to do a reading.
I bet it was Montel. Sorry.
Oh, probably. No, you're probably right.
She was always on.
Was she on there?
Montel.
Okay, then I bet, because this would have been that time, too, when Montel was, like, a big thing. So,
yeah, Montel was in his heyday.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, Sylvia Brown does a reading. She says that Amanda's dead and that she's somewhere in water. So, Amanda's...
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
Yeah. And so, that's the kind of crap that makes people very skeptical, because it's like...
Like I was talking about last week, like, mm-hmm. Sylvia Brown, like, not to speak ill of the dead, but she made so much money off of just being the biggest fraud.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And it was her name that people paid for, and yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I remember looking at one point when I was very much into Montel Williams, and I thought Sylvia Brown was fantastic. I won't lie, I loved her for a long time before.
Yeah.
I was also a young teen, let's remember that. But I remember my mom and I discussing it and, like, looking up, like, to do, like, a video or, like, a phone call reading with her was, like, for, like, 15 to 30 minutes was, like, $300-some.
Expensive? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's insane. So, yeah, her mom was, just devastated, because she was so sure that she was still alive. So, this just, like, crushed her spirit and her soul.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that happens, and let me find where I'm at. Sorry.
Can you imagine the audacity of telling a hopeful yet grieving and worried mother, "Oh no, your daughter's dead."
I know.
And just blatantly lying about
on
it.
On TV, nonetheless.
Yeah, like,
yeah.
I have a chance. It's been this long, so she's more than likely. Like, what mm-hmm. the hell?
I know. So. She still feels like she's out there, you know, because you don't know, like, you don't want to believe that. Nobody's going to want to believe that anyway, without proof. So that happens, and she's just sad, but she never stops believing that she's still alive. So then I was really sad, because about a year after that, Amanda's mom, she got really sick, and she ends up passing away. So she died without even knowing that her daughter was still alive.
Right. I remember that part of the story now too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause I think if you like look up the stuff about Sylvia Brown and the like things she was blatantly wrong on, I want to say this case is part of it. Like they told this mother who then died with thinking her daughter was probably dead.
Yeah. Yeah. Terrible.
Mm-hmm.
So so then the kind of a side note on this, kind of jumping back to the girls in the house. They were able to watch the news while they were there. I think he liked to do that because he wanted them
to
see.
Them.
Oh, yeah. So they, Michelle, the oldest, you know, she saw on the news that Amanda's mom had passed away. And so she actually broke the news to Amanda and tried to comfort her. So that was pretty sad. So now we'll kind of talk about their time in the home. The three girls were there all at the same time, obviously. Michelle even said it was terrible knowing that those other two young girls were there going through the same thing she was. I really liked her on this documentary. She just seemed very, a good person, you know?
A good person. And you got to think, she's probably got that mothering in her.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
She had the son. She was a mom. She was trying to, you know, have that. And then... it's always a horrifying thought, but I think that sometimes when you have your own children, and I'm not saying people who don't have kids can't empathize or be just as horrified, but
yeah, you just have more of that motherly like instinct.
It's that moment of just being like imagining your own child in that situation or something like that happening. And you know, these girls are so much younger than her. I mean, not Amanda,
yeah,
They were.
They're 5 years and then 7 years. So, I mean, and like, and at that point,
like little sisters,
maturity age wise, that's a big difference. If they were older,
definitely.
But you know, she's had a child, she's 21. These other girls are just high school, not even driving, you know?
I'm getting ahead too again. But I don't remember. Did some of them, is this one of the cases where some of them got impregnated and then they...
Yeah, we'll get to that part too.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm jumping
No,
ahead.
You're good. So they're there. they all are like in their own rooms, which are like, they're chained up in their own rooms. They know that each other is there. But they're in their own areas chained, and they were forced to use plastic buckets as toilets. They were emptied very infrequently. They were only fed once a day and only showered twice a week at the most. They were, however, able to watch the news and able to see their families crying and begging for help to find them. Gina's mom all along said she just had a feeling that she was alive in her heart. She said, I just, as a mother, I know she has to be alive. So Gina said that's kind of what kept her fighting. And so she was, it may gave her hope seeing them on the news. As much as that hurt, she knew that they were still looking for her.
Yeah.
So she said she would even lay awake at night and just try to think about her family and how their days were, and just trying to think of positive things and hoping they were having good days. I'm like, how sad.
Oh, that breaks my heart. That poor girl.
I know. So the next few years were just a living hell. Gina described one time specifically that Castro came into the room and he had all three women there and asked them if they wanted to play Russian roulette. And he brought out a gun. So Michelle immediately said she was shaking her head no. And he asked Gina, but Gina was 14. Like, she didn't know what that was. So she, yeah, he explains the game to her and said, when it's your turn, if you pull the trigger, I'll know that you don't like me. So she said, when he handed her the gun, she didn't even hesitate and pulled the trigger. Like, cause he showed them that he had loaded the gun. So she knew there was a bullet. And she pulls the trigger and nothing. And she said she was so disappointed. And she said she didn't even care. She said she wanted him to know that she hated him. Yeah. She didn't care what he would do to her after that. Like, she just was like, not, you know, having it. So, that's just kind of a side story on that. So Michelle, throughout the years they're there, cause this ends up, you know, a span of 12 years for her. She actually got pregnant 5 different times. And each time she got pregnant, he aborted them by beating her, starving her, hitting her in the stomach with a barbell, and throwing her downstairs. He said there's no way they could have a baby there because it would be too loud and people would figure it out. So Michelle was always mouthy, like she did not care. Yeah, she was always mouthy with him and he hated that. And I don't know like why or how, but at some point it said that she had a dog there and he just hated her so much that he was abusing her one time. And he even told her that, or that Michelle said that, if like, why do you keep getting me pregnant then if you don't want the baby, you know? Right. And she said she was just mouthy. And so then eventually when he was trying to abuse her, this dog that she had tried to protect her and it bit him, and he ends up killing the dog right in front of her. Uh-huh. Which I was sick. Yeah, that made me sick to my stomach. And I thought, like, that was probably her comfort and hope. Yeah. And the fact that that dog was protecting her, like, was amazing too. So
why would he have given her I don't understand any of the things. But like, before, when you talked about how many times she got pregnant and how he was like, we can't have a baby here, my thought was that exactly too. It was like, then why do you have these women and why do you continue to rape them?
Right. Yeah, I know. Duh. Like, there's ways you can have even prevent that. Like, not that that's ever okay, but no, you know,
but yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of where we're at on that. So then later on, he ends up getting Amanda pregnant as well. So I don't know why, but he says he lets her keep the baby. So she ends up having her baby on Christmas Day in 2006. So before she has the baby, he tells Michelle that she's going to help deliver the baby. He also tells her that if anything happens to the baby or something goes wrong during delivery, he will kill her, Michelle. And so, yeah, like, he just hated her. But I think it's because she stood up for herself and would fight for herself a lot.
It makes me wonder, which obviously I'm glad he kept her alive, but like, why he kept her alive then?
Right, right. So I don't know. Probably just to torture her because he knew, you know. But Michelle said that she knew that he was not lying and he would kill her. So she said, you know, she was there and when Amanda actually had the baby, you know, the baby, she had a girl, little girl, they named her Jocelyn. But so when she comes out, she's not crying. Michelle said she knew enough that she knew that they needed to clear the baby's lungs. So she turned her over and patted her back, and eventually the baby coughed and started crying. And so Michelle even said that out of all the ugly things that happened in that house, that it was really a beautiful moment. And it was such a miracle that she got to deliver that baby and that that baby was perfect. She said that throughout the years they're there, that Jocelyn, the baby, was such a needed and welcome distraction for them. They played with her and she helped them forget their reality.
Ugh.
I know, like, that could make me cry just talking about that. And I'm like, okay, like, I'm tired. Like, you know, that just,
no, I just, but that's heartbreaking. And you've got to think, Amanda and Gina, they were children when they were taken, and their childhood was taken, and they didn't have those experiences to bring them to that part, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, and then you have this, and I understand that Jocelyn's a comfort to them, but then it's like, you have this poor innocent child born into such a horrific thing.
I know.
And you can only hope that she's not there long enough to remember it.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, yeah, that's, yeah, so that's crazy. So we'll talk about that a little too. So after the baby's born, he makes them all change their names. It didn't say what they changed them to, but he was afraid that as the baby got older, she would see stuff on the news or she would start to figure it out and suspect something. Like, he was thinking ahead that far, which is crazy. So yeah. And he also, like, you just don't know how someone's going to, you know, if he's treating them like that, what is he going to do with the baby? No, no. He loved, thank God. I mean, you don't want him to think, well, this is that.
I mean, he clearly has other daughters.
Right, right. So he, like, spoils the crap out of her. He loves her. They even said, like, people, neighbors said they would see him outside, like, with her, and that he'd be holding her little hand and she'd be walking and he'd always have toys out there and she'd be playing with toys. They all thought that was his granddaughter. And he even told one of his kids, I think it's a son even, I'm not sure how many kids, but doesn't matter. I guess he told his son that it was his girlfriend's baby. Like, he told all these different things, but people were like, okay, at the age he is, there's no way that that's, like, his baby, you know? So,
well, I mean, men can have babies their entire lives, but
yeah, I mean, in the sense of, like, you probably don't have a, I mean, there was no woman. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they had never seen another woman there. So, yeah. So, you know, the whole time they're there, it did say that Amanda taught the baby to read and write, the baby. I guess Jocelyn wasn't a baby when she taught her, but, you know, it sounds like she was a really good mom. And she just, I mean, raised her as best as she could, you know, knowing that he was just pathetic. So, so another thing that kind of helped, I guess, after the baby was born, he kind of loosened up a little bit. I mean, not enough. I mean, he still continued his sexual assaults and all the things, but he does, like, get rid of the chains. So he adds padlocks to their rooms instead, which is still terrible, but they were no longer chained up physically, but they said they were emotionally. So he had mentally abused them so much that they were so scared to leave. And he would pin the girls against each other. He would tell them, like, if you run away, I'll kill her, and back and forth, because they had all gotten close. And so, and they said they knew he would too, you know? And so they were just so brainwashed.
You know, their comfort to each other in this. And so, I'm sure they have an unimaginable bond and they don't want to sacrifice the others so they can get away. And that's just heartbreaking.
It's sad. And so, you know, it's like, who knows? They may have had several chances to leave and didn't because they were scared. I mean, who really knows? But they just knew that he would do anything he threatened. And he even threatened that if they tried to leave too, he would hang them up by their feet and just let them hang there and let the blood all drain down to their head.
Oh, just like God.
Very graphic, horrible things. So that's kind of everything going on in the house at that point. So unfortunately, several years go by without any break in the case. the girls stop seeing themselves on TV as missing. It's not really like a news story anymore. The only time they really see themselves on the news is when it's like the anniversary of them. Like, you know, I said that weird anniversary well, of them. But,
I mean, yeah.
Them missing, you know, and they're like, it's marked this many years. And then mm-hmm. they would show their families and stuff. And side note, Gina, even her sister said after like 8 years or something at this point, she said she remembers that night she could hear her dad crying in the bedroom, like nightly. That broke my heart, you know? So, I mean, they still believed that they were out there, but there was nothing. So also this was very interesting because several of Castro's neighbors had actually called into the police about suspicious things happening around that house over the span of this whole time. So, yeah. And I don't know if it was because it was like a not good neighborhood or they just like it, crime was a thing and they just didn't take it seriously. Or because
it was probably a minority neighborhood.
Yes. Yes. The police never like looked into these things. They said on Seymour Street. So some of the different things that they had called in were someone said they had seen a woman in a window. Someone said this one was very bizarre. They saw three women in Castro's backyard with dog collars on crawling. I never heard any more on that, if that happened or not, but I'm sure there's so many unspeakable things that actually happened that you just don't even hear.
Well, so, that definitely sounds like something he would have done.
Oh yeah.
To torment them.
Absolutely. So there was other things too that just never happened. I mean, they never looked into any of it. They said police never came and police claimed like that they never had a record.
Sorry. Right. I feel like as you talk about that, I remember hearing about that, like as this case broke, mm-hmm. about how there were all these missed opportunities. Like mm-hmm. they just never called in because neighbors were like, something is going on.
Just like that case, I can't think of who it was now, where they had all the kids and they said they could see them. Like neighbors were like, they would be like marching military style. Yes, the Turpins. Thank you. Yes. And people in that case too, some people didn't even call anything in when it's like, oh my gosh, if it seems weird, it's probably weird. You know?
Yeah, that was another horrific case and it's
we'll keep going here. I got a lot. Sorry guys. I'm trying to, it's just so much. It's just such an interesting case. So they even said like people said that they would hear banging coming from the house, like banging on doors or walls. And they would see like there was plastic bags over the windows. And there would be times that he would come home and he would have like tons of bags of like food from McDonald's, but he lived by himself. Like everyone knew, and they thought that was really weird too. So, okay. This is kind of a comic relief, I guess I should say. He had a neighbor and this guy's name was Charles Ramsey. So if anything, watch the documentary just to see him because he is the best. He was so funny, just the way he talks about it. So he's talking about it and he says that he lived next to Castro and he thought he was a weird dude. He's like, I always thought he was just a weird dude. And he had his house windows were boarded up. And I said, why does this little Puerto Rican man, that's how he kept referring to him as. He's like, have his windows boarded up with no air conditioning. Cause he said there was no air conditioning. And he said, I know that Puerto Ricans are get hot, you know? And so he said that it was super weird. He goes, I don't know what it was about this guy. He said, but something about him just like captivated me in a sense of like something was going on. He said he could not figure it out, but he just knew something was off and he would talk about it with the neighbors all the time. And they'd be like, no. You know, and he just said he got to the point where he was having panic attacks at night because he was so concerned about the little Puerto Rican man, he said. And so.
Okay. But the way he says that, is he a white man?
No.
Okay.
No. Okay. I don't want to be like, yeah, no, it's
okay.
Yeah.
Cause like that he could actually be really racist sounding almost.
I mean, yes. And I'm just quoting what he said too, right, for the record, just so everyone's aware that's not, yeah. And I'm not laughing at that part of it. I'm just laughing that this guy, I think, was so blunt about it. It was funny. And if you watch the documentary, you'll see what I mean.
Yeah.
He's very likable. And I mean, ultimately, like at the end, he was kind of a hero. So we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot. Yeah. So we'll, Let me find where I'm at here. He even writes a book too, which I'll tell you the name of his book and stuff at the end. But he was, he was pretty adamant that something was going on. So he always was just very suspicious. So even over the course of this time, Castro had like friends over to his house and he was in a band. I don't know. And he had one of the bandmates at his house to practice. And they talked to him and they interview him on the documentary. And he says that it was weird because he asked Castro when he was there if he could use the bathroom. And Castro told him no. And that he noticed that several areas of the house were locked up.
You didn't find that weird at all.
Right. Yeah. So police, during all of that and all those complaints, never follow up and never show up. So then there's another weird turn of events. So in 2012, police get a letter from an inmate in an Ohio prison stating that he had killed Amanda. He told them where he put her body. And it happened to be near the area that her phone had last pinged. So they were hopeful. So they dig up this huge area and find nothing. He later on admits that he lied about it and he just wanted transferred to a different prison in, if he was convicted. So just everyone got their hopes up that they would find something and he didn't. So Castro sees this on the news and he laughs about it to the girls and he just laughs and says, you guys are never going to be found. And he thinks he's like, it's hilarious that they're so close to his house and they still can't find him. So families just keep getting their hopes up just to get them back down. So then the day that changes everything, May 6th of 2013, the day is a normal, I mean, for them, a normal day. They're all just, you know, stuck there. Michelle just casually says to Gina, what if today was the day we go home? And this like gave me goosebumps when I watched this part. And she said, Gina said, that would be amazing. But, you know, they didn't think it would happen because they dream that every day. So shortly after they have that conversation, Castro leaves. Amanda realized that he was gone and she had an opportunity to escape. He had left the doors unlocked, but he had also done this in the past, like as a test to see if they would leave and they got punished. Like they would try and then he would beat them. So they were nervous and they were like, is this a test? So they talk about how she says to Jocelyn, the little girl, something about, I can't find daddy. I'm going to look or something. So the little girl like goes up to do like upstairs or something. Cause I think she wanted to protect her in case something. Yeah. So she said that she was so nervous, but she just said, you know, she didn't know if it was a test, but she also didn't know if he was going to be back soon or not. And if she was going to do it, she had to do it then. She said that her heart was pounding and she just decided to do it. So she goes, opens the door, runs out of the house. And it's like freedom initially. And she goes to the neighbor's door and she's banging and banging on the door. And this alerts Charles Ramsey, the one neighbor we talked about. So he comes outside when he hears all the banging. He's like, what's going on? And he said, he sees this girl at the house next door and she's banging and begging them to, you know, for help. And he said, the neighbors were like, no, no, go away. Like, we don't want to be involved with this. We don't know what this drama is. So he was like, what the heck? So he specifically says he was in the middle of eating a Big Mac. And he said, my debate was like, he goes, do I finish this Big Mac or see what this girl wants? Cause he didn't know that she had come from Castro's house at this point either. Right. And he's like, so it was just funny that he talks about that. He's like, but I gave in and I let her use my phone and she called 911 and he heard, and they played the 911 call. And that gives me goosebumps. Like I have goosebumps right now just because when they played it, and of course they have the dramatic music playing on the documentary and she's screaming in the phone. I'm Amanda Berry. I'm Amanda Berry. I've been missing for 10 years. I'm free, but I need help before he comes back. And she repeats herself and, you know, and the lady's like, what, you know, where are you and stuff. So she's like, hurry, hurry. He's going to be here. Like just freaking out. Right. So the cops get there pretty quick and they ask her if anyone else is in the house. And like Charles Ramsey helps her actually kick down the door when they go back over there to get the others out before the police get there. So the cops are there and then they ask if anyone's there. So Michelle and Gina were still upstairs in their rooms, and they said that they heard like noise, and Michelle kind of peeked through the door, but Gina said she thought it was a trap. So she was scared and was not going to move. Then they heard a bunch of people, and they heard and saw the police, and they came rushing in. Can you imagine that feeling? And they said they immediately held out their badges and showed them that they were cops. And Gina says, oh, I'm getting all emotional. Why? Because it was like, it was crazy. Yeah. And Gina said they ran to the cops' arms and they said, don't let go of us. Don't let go of us. And like, so then, oh, here we go, guys. The cops that they talked to too, the cops are cry on the documentary, and that makes it like so hard to listen to, because he said that he asked Gina her name, you know, he asked her twice to repeat her name. And when she said her name, he said he just choked up, and he said, we've been looking for you for a long, long time. And so he said that, you know, they took them, and it was like that moment of just like shock. And Michelle said that her favorite memory, like in her life, was when they were all in an ambulance together. She said they were all sitting there, and she looked around, and they all just looked at each other, and Amanda reached her hand out and said, we're going home. And so she said that was like a moment she would never forget. So they go to the hospital, of course, immediately, you know, and get checked out and all of that. And their families were all there waiting for them. Well, except for Gina's family, because on the documentary, it was crazy because the dad said he had heard that some girls were at the hospital and he was going to go just see if it was Gina. And the cops, he was telling the cops this because they show up at his house. He's like, what's going on? I need to go. I need to go see. And they said, no, we're here to take you to your daughter. And because he didn't even know it was her. And he said he just like broke down, you know. And so they get to the hospital, and they said it was just crazy because there were people just lined up, like family all lined up, and everyone was just like crying. And it was like just such a reunion. So that was.
So was Jocelyn like 6 at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because she was born in 2006, right. December. So was May. So she would have. Yeah.
So she didn't get to go to school.
No. And you know, I can probably find a picture. They had pictures of her as a little girl, like in the hospital, which I was surprised they even showed that. But then there's pictures of her, like recent ones. I saw one the other day of her, and she's, you know, what are we in? Like, she's whatever age now.
So she
16, 17.
Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
And so, it's really crazy. So like, just, I think this case is just so interesting because of the fact, I mean, because they survived and they went through this, but it just makes them so strong. And like, knowing that they went through that, it's like just fascinating to see what they're doing now and where their lives are, which I'll talk about that a little bit here. I'll kind of get into where we're at, like, kind of what happens. But, so also, while the police, once they get to go into the house and really look through there and stuff, they see that the closet doors had been taken off and they were used to be screwed over the windows so nobody could see in. They found the rusted heavy chains. And they also found diaries that the girls were actually allowed to keep. That was the only thing he let them do.
I remember that, because wasn't that used as evidence?
Yep. So they described, so they read the diaries a little bit, and these are the things that were, they read that were described in there. Things like forced sexual conduct, being locked in dark rooms, anticipating the next session of abuse, dreams of escaping and reuniting with family, being chained to walls, prisoners of war, emotional abuse, threats to kill, treated like animals, and desiring freedom. Like, ugh. So Castro, which is, he's a giant piece. He gets arrested, obviously, and he gets charged with hundreds of counts. I think, I don't know if I put the actual amount in here. It ended up being like 994 or something charges
a decade.
So some of the things he's charged with are obviously include, you know, kidnapping, rape, and he actually got charged with murder for terminating all the pregnancies for Michelle.
Oh, wow.
Yep.
See, because that's always one of those things that, like, sometimes it depends on the state you're in. It does. Because in some they won't, and some they will.
Yeah. So I thought, well, good, you know? So he even told a cop, he said, yeah, I really fucked up this time. He also said, that he was a victim. He said he was a victim because he had been assaulted in Puerto Rico as a child. He said he had treated the women well. He never forced himself on them, and that he just had a way with them and they wanted to sleep with him. He said it was all consensual. Okay.
Ew. Yeah. That's why you have chains and you beat them.
Right.
And, you know, kept them against correct. Their will.
So he even went on to say that he actually had no escape plan, and he figured that he eventually would get caught. He hadn't planned any of them. He said they were just crimes of opportunity. And he even admitted that he was cold-blooded and a sex addict. And as the police were looking through the house, they actually found a suicide note that he had written that was in the house. So the note discussed the abductions, and he said his money and possessions were to be given to the kidnapped women if he ever got caught. I thought that was super interesting. Yeah. Like, he obviously, built some weird emotional connection. Yeah. Like, he felt guilty about it, but not guilty enough. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, there's more of that too towards the end. I'll talk about that more, but he, you know, he continues to plead not guilty over and over and keeps saying he denies it, which it's like, dude, the evidence is right there. Like, okay, but whatever. So eventually they take the death penalty off the table. They said, you know, if you plead guilty, we'll just take that off the table, but you're also going to forfeit any rights to any appeals.
Yeah.
So he does.
Well, that just helps the girls not have to
go through a trial.
All that. Yeah. No.
So he was sentenced to life in prison. And to serve also 1,000 years on top of that. And he was not eligible for parole. And he was also fined $100,000. So before he was sentenced, he was able to address the court. And he did for about 20 minutes. He said he was a good person and not a monster. He said he was all of these things. I'm like, okay. As I was reading them, I was like, okay, you know, but so he says he wasn't a monster. He said he was just addicted to sex and pornography. He said he never beat or tortured the women. So as he's addressing the court, he shifts between apologizing and blaming the FBI for not catching him. He also blames the victims because they got in a car with a stranger.
But you weren't also a stranger.
You were, but not. You know what I mean? No, they knew him, but not like buddies. So, no. He also discussed that he knew the girls were not virgins. He found that out. What does that have to do with anything besides being disgusting? You're a sick person. So after that, then he goes back to apologizing. And he ends with, I hope they can find it in their hearts to forgive me because we had a lot of harmony going on in that home.
Ew.
I know. In my notes here, if you could see, I literally put LOL because I was just like, are you serious right now?
I mean,
harmony in your home.
Right.
Were you that? Did he really convince himself of that, you think?
I bet to some extent he had.
Yeah, he would have had to.
Those women probably had some sort of harmony amongst themselves, especially once Jocelyn was there.
Yeah.
But not with him.
No,
not anything that was real and wasn't just to try to protect themselves.
Yeah, I was sick. So I'm glad that the victims then were given a chance to speak. I'm not sure. It only talks about Michelle's statement. I think they said maybe that someone else read, like the families read the other girls. So Michelle's statement was so good. She said, you took away 11 years of my life. I spent 11 years in hell. Now your hell is just beginning. I will overcome all that has happened, but you will face hell for eternity. I will live on and you will die a little every day as you think of the 11 years of atrocities that you inflicted on us. I can forgive you, but I will never forget. I was like, boom. So Michelle goes on and she legally changes her name. I think she just probably, you know, you don't want to be associated with all that.
Well,
so.
And you just don't want, you don't want people to recognize you for that. And then you know, there are going to be people questioning you all the time, asking you inappropriate questions.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, at this point, too, she's 32?
Yeah.
So she gets several tattoos to kind of help her cope with the healing process. And she was very into art and like drawing and, you know, how she felt that day and all that. So that was kind of cool. She said, as far as her son went, she did find out that he eventually had gotten adopted by his foster parents, and she would love to see him. But after all of this happened, she didn't want him to have to be deal with all that. And yeah. So she said she planned on connecting with him when he's an adult and wants to see her and stuff. So I thought, how mature and how hard that, to deal with that.
Right. There's so much heartbreak and heartache there. And you just hope that he had then a good life with his foster family. And
I know
that one day they can connect and he can realize that his mom didn't just abandon him.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought like,
because that she's poor just a kid, good person. Even if he had a good life, there's still going to be some trauma with that, of feeling that abandonment, you know, and stuff yeah. like that too. So,
I mean, that's traumatic. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, she, after all that too, she actually had, oh my gosh, I can't, words are hard today. Okay. it's late. It I'm happens. Tired.
Yeah.
Kids passed out over there. I'm like, she has headphones on. Don't worry, guys. She's not listening. So she had to have facial reconstruction surgery because he beat her so bad that
oh my goodness.
They had to reconstruct her jaw and all that. She also has permanent hearing loss in one of her ears. Can you imagine that from just being beat and having it not treated for how long?
I'm just thinking too of like if she had even just fractures or broken bones, like the arthritis and stuff she's probably experiencing already.
Oh yeah, totally. So, and okay. So she really hopes, you know, one day she wanted to adopt children since, it's unlikely she'll ever be able to actually get pregnant and give birth due to the injuries that she sustained.
Right.
So, she does get married though in 2016, and she had plans just to open a restaurant someday. So she also has a nonprofit to help women of abuse transition back into life after being in an abuse. Yeah. They all have done amazing things after this. So that's kind of what I'm going to just tell you what they each, where they're at now. So then Amanda and Gina, they both got their diplomas in 2015. Amanda's been raising her daughter and actually now works for the news. And it's so cool because they showed a clip on the documentary. She does the missing section, like the segment. They said it pops up and it's her, and she, you know, and it says now on missing, blah, blah, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
They say sometimes something you just see or hear helps. And then she goes in and talks about people missing. And I was like, that is so cool. Like I mean, they all somehow have tied this into what they do in one way or another. So I can't remember what the actual news station was, but I mean, that documentary was actually really great. It was like 90 minutes, but it was worth the watch. So
no, it sounds good.
It was really, really good. So, that's what she's doing. Gina actually works, helping people find their missing loved ones. So she helps them through the process. She helps them navigate it, how to handle it, and how to continue having hope when someone's missing. And I was like,
oh my God,
amazing.
These
you know?
Women.
I know. Incredible. So they all turned out amazing, and they talked to the cops and stuff. And they just said, all of them were like, they are amazing women. The like, just the resilience and, you know, I mean, it's just incredible. So 30 days, then we'll go back to Castro, kind of give you the ending of his little story. 30 days after he was sentenced, he ended up taking his own life in his prison cell. So he hung himself with his bed sheets. And when they, yeah, exactly. And that's exactly on the documentary. Michelle says, you know, he took the cowardly way out. I wanted him to every day go through something terrible, you know? And she said, of course he did that. So when they found him, they did try, you know, they performed CPR on him.
Right.
And he was rushed to the hospital and he died there. So this is the best part. This is kind of the final little part that I have. The final part of the plea bargain that Castro took was that Seymour house would be demolished and blurred out on Google Maps, which I thought was like really cool. Like the blurring it out thing, even taking that step to do that.
Yeah.
So the house was demolished on August 7th of 2013. Michelle was there and she handed out yellow balloons that represent missing children. Oh. They said it was like so powerful because right when the first, whatever they did first, at the same time that they started, you know, breaking it down, everyone like released their balloons and they said it was just like such an, I have goosebumps and you can't see it through there, but like, cause like, it was just so deep. Yeah. So that was like the final thing and it's gone. And, you can't see it on Google Maps, which is amazing. And that's kind of the story with that. So like I said, that Discovery Plus, that's where that, the documentary that I feel like was the most informative. There are several like clips, of course, you can find online from like, you know, 2020 and stuff, but there's actually a Lifetime movie as well. I watched this years ago and I couldn't find it right now. Like you can buy it, but you can't rent it on any platform, which is really weird. So it's called Cleveland Abduction. It's Taryn Manning plays Michelle Knight. I don't know if you know Taryn Manning.
Name sounds familiar.
She's like on Orange is the New Black. She plays like the hillbilly with,
Council Tucky.
Yes. There you go. I couldn't think of her name. Yes. That girl.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, but yeah, that's a good one. Obviously it's, you know, dramatized cause it's a movie,
it's
but,
Lifetime.
Charles Ramsey's book, I have to tell you the name of this. It's called Dead Giveaway, The Rescue, Hamburgers, White Folks, and Instant Celebrity, .. What you saw on the news doesn't begin to tell the story.
Didn't he say something about a white girl on the porch or something like that in his news interview?
Yeah,
I think
he
remember
was so
that.
Funny, but like a good guy, but like clearly no filter, you know?
Right. Cause didn't he say something about, I feel like it was something about some white girl come running up to me and I knew something was wrong.
Yes. Okay. I forgot about that till you just said it. Yeah. He said this little white girl, running up to me. Yes. That's So I want to read his book. Cause I didn't realize that there was a book. I'm sure it's kind of interesting just to see it all from different sides.
Right.
So Michelle Knight actually wrote two different books. So she wrote one that came out in 2014 called Finding Me, Decade of Darkness, A Life Reclaimed. And it's just a memoir of their kidnappings. And then in 2018, the book she wrote is called Life After Darkness, Finding Healing and Happiness After the Kidnappings. And then Amanda Berry and Gina De Jesus wrote a book together in 2015 called Hope, a memoir. I can't even say that word right now, Cassie. Words are hard for me.
Memoir?
Thank you. Yes. Yes. That's it. Of survival in Cleveland. So they all have books. There's some interesting things. I remember reading in the past, and I kind of looked it up to see where they said that like Amanda and Gina didn't like Michelle and there was some tension there. I remember seeing this a lot. And when I was researching that popped up a lot and they, you know, everyone's like, well, why? And, I guess they said though, that he just really like turned them all against each other too. And he would tell them things. And I think, Michelle kind of wanted to just, you know, everybody copes with things different.
Right.
And I think maybe she wanted more space from what it sounds like. And they all just needed to kind of heal on their own. And I think there was some maybe drama or her, you know, her
probably
feelings
hurt
on that.
In that.
So,
cause that's one thing I was going to ask was if they all remained close or kind of separate, because I could see it going either way. I could see
totally
not wanting to see these people who are a constant reminder of these horrendous things you went through, or needing to have these people who understood like no one else could. I could see that going either way. And so if Michelle was like, I love you guys, but I can't, I could see them
until I'm like in a place.
I could see them, especially if they were younger, you know, they'd been taken at younger ages and stuff. I could see the hurt from that too.
And I think, like with time, I'm sure things, you know, maybe they could, I don't know. I don't know how bad the drama really was. And maybe, you know, the media can make it worse.
Oh, I'm sure the
is.
Media. Yeah. And again, it's one of those things that like, even if Michelle isn't close with them now, I wonder too, how much, you know, because she was there for Jocelyn's birth, you know, and that stuff.
That's a huge thing. They're going to be tied together, yeah. I mean, forever. And they went through something insane together.
I'm sure even if they don't see each other a ton or talk a ton, with all that it sounds like these women have done to bring themselves to a healed, or not a healed, but like to heal themselves and take themselves to a healthier spot.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's no longer any hurt feelings. I'm sure there's understanding on other people's parts about the different ways people are going to cope with this trauma.
Right. And I'm sure, yeah, the more they mature and stuff, they can see mm-hmm. that. I mean, initially too, you just, I don't know, you expect people to react the way you are when you're younger. Well, yeah. And think about the fact that they were there for so long. They missed such pivotal moments in their lives of like, right. yeah, growing and well, learning, I mean, things, social yeah. things, cues, even
social,
you know?
Cues and all these. But then even look at Michelle. She had 5 pregnancies that he forcefully terminated.
God, that's traumatic.
Amanda was able to keep her baby, and then Michelle was forced to mm-hmm. you know, help her through it, which it sounds like Michelle didn't have any hard feelings, but there's got to, I mean, even subconsciously, there has to be this.
Like, why did she get to? Like,
yeah. And now Michelle can't have her own children, and she lost out on having that relationship with her son and him growing. Like, there's so many faucets of trauma here.
Yeah. And I feel like
I can't even fathom.
He almost, because he was so cruel, I feel like he almost had Amanda have that baby just to punish Michelle, because she, you know,
he's right, because Michelle sick. You know, it seems like it was probably another form of torture for mm-hmm. Michelle,
and the fact that they were at home. I know people have like
at home
birth at home, yeah, but like no
yeah, but they still, okay, people who are doing at home birth still usually have a doula,
yes,
or someone who has some sort of training there,
educated, yeah.
And if something goes wrong, the doula's not worried about being murdered,
right?
And they right. know they can call an ambulance,
right? And like, they were not prepared in any way. It was just like, no. Well, when the baby comes, I mean, there was no prenatal, you know, care, yeah. any of that. So the fact that she was, you know, came out perfect is amazing. Yeah. And it's funny because, well, not funny once again, but Gina's mom said that when they first saw her, she goes, it was just like, I had just, like, she was a new baby. She goes, I counted all her fingers and her toes, and I made sure they were all still there. And they said it was almost like a rebirth type thing because it had yeah. been so long. So it's like a okay. very inspirational story. It's one of those, I mean, they all tug at your heartstrings no matter what the case is, but right. this one was like, oh, it's awful that they went through that, but they're alive to tell that story. So,
well, anytime you can actually hear the like survivor oh, yeah. stories, like, oh my God, that's why I have a hard time watching like I Survived. Like, it's great.
I know.
And it's not always like horrible, like true crime yeah. stuff. Sometimes it's like it was a car accident.
Yeah, a car crash
something.
Or like stuck in a blizzard. I watched one of those. Yeah. Yesterday.
But like, but still, yeah. like, you, like, it's always, I'll cry every time at those.
I know. I was like bawling, and I'm like, what? Wow. No. And, but I mean, I'll cry at anything, but like yeah. this one, I mean, I could watch one where someone died and I wouldn't cry, but this one, it was like just all the feels. And I think a lot of it was one of the cops in the thing, he turns away and he says, I need to take a minute. And you see him like physically crying. And another one just stops talking for a minute and gets choked up. And it's like seeing men like that too, crying, you know, and like knowing how hard it was on them just being there, but not even like knowing them.
Yeah. Well, this is one of those situations where it's like, it didn't have to go on for this long. There were so many things that.
That's what's crazy is that it was that long, I think.
Yep. And then the fact of just knowing, again, like we said, like so many people's lives were affected by this. Like, these women have horrendous trauma, but there was, again, like I said, Michelle's son probably had some sort of, you know, abandonment stuff. Like, that's, you know, a thing they found. Uh-huh. Like, even in infants can happen, you know, who are put yeah. up for adoption. And, I mean, just so many things, you know? And it's just heartbreaking and horrendous. And to see yeah. these women making something of their lives to put yeah. forth, you know, to help
to prevent
other women.
Stuff. Yeah. I think, yeah, it's just crazy. Yeah. To see what they've done with it. And I mean, I think even Elizabeth Smart, like, wasn't she, was it just like a year? Was she gone a year or was it more? It was a while,
hers,
right?
Hers was still a little while too, I think.
Let me, I'm looking it up because, I mean,
she's anytime, done a lot too.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Anytime something like that happens, it's traumatic.
Yeah. But no, she was gone for a while too. Cause they got to the point where they were comfortable taking her out in public.
Let's see. How many years was she missing? Okay. So she was.
She was quite a while because they had the
nine. It says only 9 months.
That was it? Wasn't Elizabeth Smart the one in the back in the compound?
The like, Mormon like girl? Made the,
huh?
Yeah, like behind the house where she could hear him searching for her.
Yeah. And like, yeah, did she have
it
a
was
baby?
Only 9 months, though.
I thought she had a baby, too. Maybe I'm thinking of another one.
No, I mean, he assaulted her, but I don't think. Yeah. No, I'm just like looking now because it's like, gosh, it's been so long. I feel like there's, are you thinking of JC Dugard maybe? She was taken for years. Do you remember her?
That's who I'm thinking of.
18 years, I think, is what she was. Yeah, because she was finally to the point where she was like free to go, but she just stayed because she didn't know what else, you know, that was, that's a whole nother one. But
that's, yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
See? Yeah. So this one was, I liked it because it was a different, we're trying to kind of try all different things across the board as far as different cases. We're not, so,
yeah. We'll link all of their books and the documentary in the show notes too. I think it's important that their stories are shared.
I think I'm ready to like have all their books in my cart on Amazon. I'm like, I'm just buying them all and reading them all because this, it's just so interesting. And especially like, you know, we knew about it, but we didn't know the details. Cause when I was reading some of this, I was like, oh my gosh, this is even worse than I thought. So, you might find yourself intrigued by some of these cases that we do. And so that's why we like to give those resources so you guys can see where we're coming from. So,
yeah, especially cause in some of them, like we might leave out stuff and everything. Like a lot of times with the, like her, I'm sure there was more about Ariel Castro that could have been said. And I mean, that's just not, you know,
like you could do a whole podcast series on just this case. So
yeah,
we just pick out the parts that are most, we can fit into time. This is probably one of the longer ones we've had and I apologize, but there was just so much because there were so many victims and
right. And I think it's important to share their story and that, you know, that's, oh my goodness.
I like want to meet these women and just, I'm like, oh my gosh, they're amazing.
Maybe we can find even like some national hotline for like domestic abuse violence or something like that we can link.
Cause I was like, there has to be like, I wonder, I mean, every place has like their own missing children stuff too, but there has to be like a national type thing. And I think
I'm sure
it's just like, if anything, you really want to like stress that if you see something weird that is unnormal, even if you're like, okay, that's, I don't want to be the person, that person, I feel like that's always how these cases get you know, like cracked is because
you
of
find
one
out
person.
Later. Yeah. Or you find out later, like, oh my goodness, I felt weird about this. And I didn't. And
just be aware of those things.
We'll discuss after this or, you know, later on before this episode gets posted, we'll kind of look more into that. But, since we've gone kind of long, I'll just do a quick reminder, you guys, rate and review, let us know, gosh, you know, I hate to end. I guess, you know, it's a heavy episode, but like there is such hope there. So, you know, rate, review, message us on any of our socials. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Those will be posted in the show notes as well. Or you can email us at heartland.darklandpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, stay heartland kind,
but darkland wary.